and let him kiss her on the forehead. If I had been married to him when first I became marriageable, North Wales might never have become a Christian land. But it isn't too late. There are those who have not forgotten that the king still wears, however faded, the serpents of Avalon about his arms. And he has married one who was a high priestess of the lady. I could have done her work better here than all those years at Arthur's court in Guinevere's shadow. It occurred to Morgaine that Guinevere would have been content with a husband like Urien's, whom she could keep within her own sphere, rather than one like Arthur, living an entire life in which she had no part. And there had been a time, too, when Morgaine had had influence with Arthur. The influence of the woman he had first taken in coming to manhood, who wore, for him, the face of the goddess. Yet, in her folly and pride, she had let him fall into the hands of Guinevere and the priests. Now, when it was too late, she began to understand what Vivien had intended. Between us we could have ruled this land. They would have called Guinevere the High Queen, but she would have had Arthur only in body. He would have been mine in heart and soul and mind. Oh, what a fool I was! He and I could have ruled for Avalon. Now Arthur is the priest's creature, and he bears still the great sword of the Druid Regalia, and the Merlin of Britain does nothing to hinder him. I must take up the work that Vivien let fall. Ah, goddess, I have forgotten so much. And then she stopped, shaking at her own daring. Urien's had reached a pause in his tale. She had ceased rubbing his feet, and he looked down, questioning at her. And she said hastily, "I'm quite sure you did the right thing, my dear husband," and spread some more of the sweet-smelling salve on her hands. She hadn't the slightest idea what she had agreed to, but Urien smiled and went on with his tale, and Morgaine slid off into her own thoughts again. I am a priestess still. Strange how I am suddenly sure of that again, after all these years, when even the dreams of Avalon are gone. She pondered what Accolon had told them. Elaine had borne a daughter. She herself couldn't give Avalon a daughter, but as Vivien had done, she would bring her a fosterling. She helped Urien's to dress, went down with him, and with her own hands fetched him fresh new-baked bread from the kitchen and some of the foaming new beer. She served him, spreading honey on his bread. Let him think her the most doting of his subjects. Let him think her only his sweet, compliant wife. It meant nothing to her, but one day it might mean much to have his trust, so that she could do what she chose.
Even with the summer my old bones ache.
I think, Morgaine, that I will ride south to Aquae Sulis and take the waters there. There is an ancient shrine to Sul. When the Romans were here, they built a huge bathhouse, and some of it is still there, unfallen. The great pools are choked, and when the Saxons came, they carried off much of the fine work and threw down the statue of the goddess. But the spring is still there, undamaged, boiling up in clouds of steam day after day, year after year, from the forges at the centre of the earth. It is awesome to behold. And there are hot pools where a man can soak all the weariness from his bones. I haven't been there for 2 or 3 years, but I shall go again, now the countryside is quiet.
I see no reason you shouldn't, she agreed, now there is peace in the land.
Would you care to go with me, my dear? We can leave my sons to care for everything here, and the old shrine would interest you.
I would like to see the shrine, she said, sincerely enough. She thought of the cold, unfailing waters of the Holy Well on Avalon, bubbling up, inexhaustible, forever, sourceless, cool, clear. Still, I don't know if it would be well to leave all things in your son's hands. Avaloch is a fool. Accolon is clever, but he is only a younger son.
I don't know if your people would listen to him. Perhaps if I were here, Avaloch would take counsel of his younger brother.
An excellent idea, my dear, Urien said sunnily. And in any case it would be a long journey for you. If you are here, I will not have the slightest hesitation in leaving all things to the young men. I will tell them they must come to you for good advice in all things.
And when will you set forth?
It wouldn't be at all a bad thing, Morgaine thought, if it were known that Uriens didn't hesitate to leave his kingdom in her hands.
Tomorrow, perhaps? Or even after the blessing of the crops this day? Will you have them pack my things?
Are you sure you can travel that long a road? It isn't an easy ride, even for a young man.
Come, come, my dear. I'm not yet too old to ride,
he said, frowning a little.
And I'm sure the waters will do me good.
I'm sure they will.
Morgaine rose, leaving her own breakfast almost untasted. Let me call your body servant and have everything made ready for you to depart. She stood at his side during the long procession around the fields, standing on a little hill above the village and watching the capering dancers like young goats. She wondered if any of them so much as knew the significance of the phallic green wands wound about with red and white garlands, and the pretty girl with her hair streaming, who walked serene and indifferent among them. She was fresh and young, not 14, and her hair was coppery gold, streaming halfway between her waist and knees, and she had on a gown dyed green that looked very old. Did any of them know what they were watching, or see the incongruity of the priest's procession following them, two boys in black carrying candles and crosses, and the priest intoning the prayers in his bad Latin? Morgaine spoke better Latin than he.
These priests hate fertility and life so much. It's a miracle their so-called blessing doesn't blast the field sterile. It was like an answer from her own mind when a voice spoke softly behind her.
I wonder, lady, if any here save ourselves truly know what they are watching.
Accolon took her arm for a moment to help her over a rough clump of the ploughed land, and she saw again the serpents, fresh and blue, along his wrists.
King Urien's knows and has tried to forget.
That seems to me a worse blasphemy than not to know at all. She had expected that would make him angry, had, in a way, been inviting it. With Accolon's strong hands on her arm, she felt the strong hunger, the inner leap. He was young, he was a virile man, and she... She was the aging wife of his old father. And the eyes of Urien's subjects were on them, and the eyes of his family and his house priest. She couldn't even speak freely. She must treat him with cold detachment, her stepson. If Accolon had said anything kind or pitying, she would scream aloud, would tear at her hair, at her face and flesh with her nails. But Accolon only said, in a voice that couldn't have been overheard 3 feet away, "Perhaps it is enough for the lady that we know, Morgaine. The goddess will not fail us while a single worshipper gives her what is due." For a moment she looked round at him. His eyes were dwelling on her, and although his hands on her were careful, courteous, detached, it seemed that heat ran upward from them into her whole body. She was suddenly frightened and wanted to pull away. "I am his father's wife, and of all women I am the one most forbidden to him. I am more forbidden to him in this Christian land than I was to Arthur." And then a memory from Avalon surfaced in her mind, something she hadn't thought of for a decade. One of the druids giving instruction in the secret wisdom to the young priestesses had said, "If you would have the message of the gods to direct your life, look for that which repeats again and again for this is the message given you by the gods, the karmic message you must learn for this incarnation. It comes again and again, until you have made it part of your soul and your enduring spirit. What has come to me again and again? Every man she had desired had been too close kin to her. Lancelot, who was the son of her foster mother. Arthur, her own mother's son. Now the son of her husband. But they are too close kin to me only by the laws made by the Christians who seek to rule this land. To rule it in a new tyranny. Not alone to make the laws, but to rule the mind and heart and soul. Am I living out in my own life all the tyranny of that law, so I, as priestess, may know why it must be overthrown? She discovered that her hands, still tightly held in Acolan's, were trembling. She said, trying to collect her scattered thoughts, "Do you truly believe that the goddess would withdraw her life from this earth if the folk who dwell here should no longer give her her due?" It was the sort of remark that might have been made, priestess to priest in Avalon. Morgaine knew, as well as anyone, that the true answer to that question was that the gods were what they were, and did their will upon the earth regardless of whether man regarded their doing one way or the other. But Acolon said, with a curious animal flash of white teeth in a grin, "Then we must make it sure, lady, that she should always be given her due, lest the life of the world fail." And then he addressed her by a name never spoken except by priest to priestess in ritual. And Morgaine felt her heart beating so hard she was dizzy. "Lest the life of the world fail. Lest my life fail within me. He has called on me in the name of the goddess." "Be still," she said, distracted. "This is neither the time nor the place for such talk."
"No."
They had come to the edge of the rough ground. He let go of her hand, and somehow her own felt cold without it. Ahead of them the masked dancers shook their phallic wands and capered, and the spring maiden, her long hair buffeted and tangled by the breeze, was going around the circle of the dancers, exchanging a kiss with each, a ritualized formal kiss, where her lips barely touched each cheek. Uriens beckoned Morgaine impatiently to his side. She moved stiffly and cold, feeling the spot on her wrists where Acolon had held her as a spot of heat on her icy body. Uriens said fussily,
"It is your part, my dear, to give out these things to the dancers who have entertained us this day."
He motioned to a servant, who filled Morgaine's hands with sweets and candied fruits. She tossed them to the dancers and the spectators, who scrambled for them, laughing and pushing. Always mockery of the sacred things. A memory of the day when the folk scrambled for bits of the flesh and blood of the sacrifice. Let the rite be forgotten, but not mocked this way. Again and yet again they filled her hands with the sweets, and again she tossed them into the crowd. They saw no more in the rite than dancers who had entertained them. Had they all forgotten? The spring maiden came up to Morgaine, laughing and flushed with innocent pride. Morgaine saw now that although she was lovely, her eyes were shallow, her hands thick and stubby with work in the fields. She was only a pretty peasant girl trying to do the work of a priestess, without the slightest idea what she was doing. It was folly to resent her. Yet she is a woman, doing the mother's work in the best way she has ever been told. It isn't her fault that she wasn't schooled in Avalon for the great work. Morgaine didn't quite know what was expected of her, but as the girl knelt for a moment before the queen, Morgaine took on the half-forgotten stance of a priestess in blessing, and felt, for an instant, the old awareness of something shadowing her, above her, beyond. She laid her hands for a moment on the girl's brow, felt the momentary flow of power between them, And the girl's rather stupid face was transfigured for a moment.
The goddess works in her too, Morgaine thought.
And then she saw Accolon's face. He was looking at her in wonder and awe. She had seen that look before, when she brought down the mists from Avalon. And the awareness of power flooded her as if she were suddenly reborn.
I am alive again. After all these years, I am a priestess again. And it was Accolon who brought it back to me.
And then the tension of the moment broke, and the girl backed away, stumbling over her feet and dropping a clumsy curtsy to the royal party. Uriens distributed coins to the dancers, and a somewhat larger gift to the village priest for candles to burn in his church, and the royal party went homeward. Morgaine walked sedately at Uriens' side, her face a mask, but inwardly seething with life. Her stepson, Uwain, came and walked beside her.
"It was prettier than usual this year, Mother. Shanai so lovely, the spring maiden, the daughter of the blacksmith Ewan. But you, Mother, when you were blessing her, you looked so beautiful. You should have been the spring maiden yourself."
"Come, come," she chided the boy, laughing. "Do you really think I could dress in green with my hair flying and dance all round the ploughed fields that way? And I am no maiden."
"No," said Uwain, surveying her with a long look. "But you look like the goddess. Father Ian says that the goddess was really a demon who came to keep the folk from serving the good Christ. But you know what I think? I think that the goddess was here for people to worship before they were taught how to worship the Holy Mother of Christ."
Accolon was walking beside them. He said, "Before the Christ, the goddess was. And it will not hurt if you think of her as Mary, Uwain. You should always do service to the lady, under whatever name. But I wouldn't advise you to speak much about this to Father Ian."
"Oh, no," said the boy, his eyes wide. "He does not approve of women, even when they are goddesses."
"I wonder what he thinks of queens," Morgaine murmured. Then they had arrived back at the castle, and Morgaine had to see to King Urien's travelling things. And in the confusion of the day, she let the new insights slide into the back of her mind, knowing that later she would have to consider all this most seriously. Urien's rode away after midday, with his men-at-arms and a body-servant or two, taking leave of Morgaine tenderly with a kiss, counselling his son Avaloch to listen to Accolon's counsel, and that of the queen in all things. Uwain was sulking. He wanted to go with his father, whom he adored. But Uriens wouldn't be troubled with a child in the party. Morgaine had to comfort him, promise some special treat for him while his father was away. But at last all was quiet, and Morgaine could sit alone before the fire in the great hall. Maeline had taken her children off to bed, and think of all that had befallen her that day. It was twilight outside, the long evening of midsummer. Morgaine had taken her spindle and distaff in her hand, but she was only pretending to spin, twirling it once in a while, and drawing out a little thread. She disliked spinning as much as ever, and one of the few things she had asked of Uriens was that she might employ two extra spinning women so that she would be free of that detested task. She did twice her share of the household weaving in its stead. She dared not spin. It would throw her into that strange state between sleep and waking, and she feared what she might see. So now she only twirled the spindle now and again, that none of the servants would see her sitting with her hands idle. Not that anyone would have the right to reproach her. She was busy early and late. The room was darkening, a few slashes of crimson light from the setting sun still brilliant, darkening the corners by contrast. Morgaine narrowed her eyes, thinking of the red sun setting over the ringstones on the tor, of the priestesses walking in train behind the red torchlight, spilling it into the shadows. For a moment, Raven's face flickered before her, silent, enigmatic. And it seemed that Raven opened her silent lips and spoke her name. Faces floated before her in the twilight. Elaine, her hair all unbound as the torchlight caught her in Lancelot's bed. Guinevere, angry and triumphant at Morgaine's wedding. The calm, still face of the strange woman with braided fair hair. The woman she had seen only in dreams. Lady of Avalon. Raven again, frightened, entreating. Arthur, bearing a candle of penitence as he walked among his subjects. Oh, but the priests would never dare force the king to public penance, would they? And then she saw the barge of Avalon, draped all in black for a funeral, and her own face, like a reflection on the mists, mirrored there, with three other women draped all in black like the barge, and a wounded man lying white and still in her lap. Torchlight flared crimson across the dark room, and a voice said, "Are you trying to spin in the dark, mother?" Confused by the light, Morgaine looked up and said peevishly, "I've told you not to call me that." Accolon put the torch into a bracket and came to sit at her feet. "The goddess is mother to us all, lady. And I acknowledge you as such." "Are you mocking me?" Morgaine demanded, agitated. "I do not mock." As Accolon knelt close to her, his lips trembled. "I saw your face today. Would I mock that, wearing these?" He thrust out his arms, and by a trick of the light the blue serpents dyed on his wrists seemed to writhe and thrust up their painted heads. "Lady, mother, goddess." His painted arms went out around her waist, and he buried his head in her lap. He muttered, "Yours is the face of the goddess to me." As if she moved in a dream, Morgaine put out her hands to him, bending to kiss the back of his neck where the soft hair curled. Part of her was wondering, frightened. "What am I doing? Is it only that he has called on me in the name of the goddess, priest to priestess? Or is it only that when he touches me, speaks to me, I feel myself woman and alive again after all this time, when I have felt myself old, barren, half dead in this marriage to a dead man and a dead life?" Accolon raised his face to her, kissed her full on the lips. Morgaine, yielding to the kiss, felt herself melting, opened, a shudder, half pain, half pleasure, running through her as his tongue against hers shot waking memories through her whole body. So long, so long, this long year when her body had been deadened, never letting itself wake, lest it be aware of what Uriens was doing. She thought, defiant, "I am a priestess. My body is mine to be given in homage to her. What I did with Uriens was the sin, the submission to lust. This is true and holy." His hands trembled on her body, but when he spoke, his voice was quiet and practical. "I think all the castle folk are abed. I knew you would be here, waiting for me." For a moment, Morgaine resented his certainty. Then she bowed her head. They were in the hands of the goddess, and she would not refuse the flow that carried her on, like a river. Long, long she had only whirled about in a backwater, and now she was washed clean into the current of life again. "Where is Avalok?" He laughed shortly. "He has gone down to the village to lie with the spring maiden. It is one of our customs that the village priest does not know. Ever, since our father was old and we were grown men, it has been so. And Avalok doesn't think it incompatible with his duty as a Christian man to be the father of his people, or as many of them as possible, like Uriens himself in his youth. Avalok offered to cast lots with me for the privilege, and I had started to do so, Then I remembered your hands blessing her, and knew where my true homage lay. She murmured, half in protest, "Avalon is so far away." He said, with his face against her breast, "But she is everywhere." Morgaine whispered, "So be it," and rose. She pulled him upright with her and made a half turn toward the stairs, then stopped. No, not here. There wasn't a bed in this castle that they could honorably share. And the druid Maxim returned to her. "Can that which was never made nor created by man be worshipped under a roof made by human hands?" Out then, into the night. As they stepped into the empty courtyard, a falling star rushed downward across the sky, so swiftly that for an instant it seemed to Morgaine that the heavens reeled and the earth moved backward under her feet. Then it was gone, leaving their eyes dazzled. "A portent. The goddess welcomes me back to herself." "Come," she whispered, her hand in Acheron's, and led him upward to the orchard, where the white ghosts of blossom drifted in the darkness and fell around them. She spread her cloak on the grass like a magic circle under the sky, held out her arms and whispered, "Come." The dark shadow of his body over her blotted out the sky and the stars. Morgaine speaks. "Even as we lay together under the stars that midsummer, I knew that what we had done was not so much love-making as a magical act of passionate power, that his hands, the touch of his body, were reconsecrating me priestess, and that it was her will. Blind as I was to all at that moment, I heard around us in the summer night the sound of whispers, and I knew that we were not alone. He would have held me in his arms, but I rose, driven on by whatever power held me now at this hour, and raised my hands above my head, bringing them down slowly, my eyes closed, my breath held in the tension of power. And only when I heard him gasp in awe did I venture to open my eyes, to see his body rimmed with that same faint light which edged my own. It is done, and she is with me. Mother, I am unworthy in thy sight, but now it has come again." I held my breath to keep from breaking out into wild weeping. After all these years, after my own betrayal and my faithlessness, she has come again to me, and I am priestess once more. A pale glimmer of moonlight showed me, at the edge of the field where we lay, though I saw not even a shadow, the glimmer of eyes like some animal in the hedgerow. We weren't alone. The little people of the hills had known where we were, and what she wrought here, and come to see the consummation unknown here since Urien's grew old, and the world had turned grey and Christian. I heard the echo of a reverent whisper, and returned it in a tongue of which I knew less than a dozen words, just audible where I stood, and where Acheron still knelt in reverence. "It is done, so let it be." I bent and kissed him on the brow, repeating, "It is done. Go, my dear. Be thou blessed." He would have stayed, I know, had I been the woman with whom he had come into that garden. But before the priestess, he went silently away, not questioning the word of the goddess. There was no sleep for me that night. Alone, I walked in the garden till dawn, and I knew already, shaking with terror, what must be done. I didn't know how, or whether alone I could do what I had begun. But as I had been made priestess so many years ago and renounced it, so must I retrace my steps alone. This night I had been given a great grace, but I knew there would be no more signs for me, and no help given until I had made myself, alone, unaided, again the priestess I had been trained to be. I bore still on my brow, faded beneath that housewifely coif Urien's would have me wear, the sign of her grace, but that wouldn't help me now. Gazing at the fading stars, I didn't know whether or no the rising sun would surprise me at my vigil. The sun tides hadn't run in my blood for half a lifetime, and I no longer knew the precise place on the eastern horizon where I should turn to salute the sun at its rising. I knew not any more even how the moon tides ran with the cycles of my body. So far had I come from the training of Avalon. Alone? With no more than a fading memory, I must somehow recapture all the things I had once known as part of myself. Before dawn I went silently indoors, and moving in the dark, found for myself the one token I had of Avalon, the little sickle knife I had taken from Vivian's dead body, a knife like the one I had borne as priestess and had abandoned in Avalon when I fled from there. I bound it silently around my waist, beneath my outer garments. It would never leave my side again, and it would be buried with me. I wore it thus, hidden there, the only memory I could keep of that night. I didn't even paint the crescent anew on my brow, partly because of Urien's, he would have questioned it, and partly because I knew I wasn't yet worthy to bear it. I wouldn't have worn the crescent as he wore the faded serpents about his arms, an ornament and a half-forgotten reminder of what he had once been and was no more. Over these next months, and as they stretched into years, one part of me moved like a painted doll through the duties he demanded of me, spinning and weaving, making herbal medicines, looking to the needs of son and grandson, listening to my husband's talk, embroidering him fine clothes, and tending him in sickness. All these things I did without much thought, with the very surface of my mind and body gone numb for those times when he took brief and distasteful possession of it. But the knife was there to touch now and again for reassurance, as I learned again to count sun tides from equinox to solstice, and back to equinox again. Count them painfully on my fingers like a child or a novice priestess. It was years before I could feel them running in my blood again, or know to a hairline's difference where on the horizon moon or sun would rise or set for the salutations I learned again to make. Again, late at night, while the household lay sleeping round me, I would study the stars, letting their influence move in my blood as they wheeled and swung around me until I became only a pivot point on the motionless earth, centre of the whirling dance around and above me, the spiralling movement of the seasons. I rose early and slept late, so that I might find hours to range into the hills, on pretext of seeking root and herb for medicines. And there I sought out the old lines of force, tracing them from standing stone to hammerpool. It was weary work, and it was years before I knew even a few of them near to Urien's castle. But even in that first year, when I struggled with fading memory, trying to recapture what I had known so many years ago, I knew my vigils were not unshared. I was never unattended, though never did I see more than I had seen that first night, the gleam of an eye in the darkness, a flicker of motion out of the corner of my eyes. They were seldom seen, even here in the far hills, anywhere in village and field. They lived their own life, secretly in deserted hills and forests where they had fled when the Romans came. But I knew they were there, that the little folk who had never lost sight of her watched over me. Once in the far hills I found a ring of stones, not a great one like that which stood on the Tor at Avalon, nor the greater one which had once been Temple of the Sun on the great chalk plains. Here the stones were no more than shoulder high, even on me, and I'm not tall, and the circle no greater than the height of a tall man. A small slab of stone, the stains faded and overgrown with lichens, was half buried in the grass at the centre. I pulled it free of weed and lichen, and as I did whenever I could find food unseen in the kitchens, left for her people such things as I knew seldom came to them. A slab of barley bread, a bit of cheese, a lump of butter. And once, when I went there, I found at the very centre of the stones a garland of the scented flowers which grew on the border of the fairy country, dried. They would never fade. When next I took Accolon out of doors when the moon was full, I wore them tied about my brow as we came together in that solemn joining which swept away the individual and made us only goddess and god, affirming the endless life of the cosmos, the flow of power between male and female as between earth and sky. After that, I went never unattended beyond my own garden. I knew better than to look for them directly. But they were there, and I knew they would be there if I needed them. It wasn't for nothing that I'd been given that old name, Morgaine of the Fairies. And now they acknowledged me as their priestess and their queen. I came to the stone circle, walking by night, when the harvest moon sank low in the sky, and the breath of the fourth winter grew cold on the eve of the Day of the Dead. There, wrapped in my cloak and shivering through the night, I kept the vigil, fasting. Snow was drifting out of the sky when I rose and turned my steps homeward. But as I left the circle, I turned my foot on a stone which hadn't been there when I came thither, and bending my head, I saw the pattern of white stones arranged. I bent, moving one stone to make the next in sequence of the magical numbers. The tides had shifted, and now we were under the winter's stars. Then I went home, shivering, to tell a story of being benighted in the hills and sleeping in an empty shepherd's hut. Uriens had been frightened by the snow and sent two men to seek me. Snow, lying deep on the mountain sides, kept me within doors much of the winter. But I knew when the storms would lift, and risked the journey to the ringstones at midwinter, knowing the stones would be clear. Snow lay never within the great circles, I knew, and I guessed that it would be so here in the smaller circles, where magic was still done. And there, at the very centre of the circle, I saw a tiny bundle, a scrap of leather tied with sinew. My fingers were recapturing their old skill, and didn't fumble as I untied it and rolled the contents into my palm. They looked like a couple of dried seeds, but they were the tiny mushrooms which grew so rarely near Avalon. They were no use as food, and most folk thought them poison, for they would cause vomiting and purging and a bloody flux. But taken sparingly, fasting, they could open the gates to the sight. This was a gift more precious than gold. They grew not in this country at all, and I could only guess how far the little folk had wandered in search of them. I left them what food I had brought, dried meats and fruits and a honeycomb, but not in repayment. The gift was priceless. I knew that I would lock myself within my chamber at midwinter, and there seek again the sight I had renounced. With the gates of vision thus opened, I could seek and dare the very presence of the goddess, begging to repronounce what I had forsworn. I had no fear that I would be cast forth again. It was she who sent me this gift, that I might seek again her presence. And I bent to the ground in thanksgiving, knowing that my prayers had been heard, and my penance done. Chapter 10. The snow was beginning to melt off the hills, and a few of the earliest wild flowers showed in sheltered valleys when the Lady of the Lake was summoned to the barge to greet the Merlin of Britain. Kevin looked pale and worn, his face haggard, his twisted limbs dragging more reluctantly than ever, and he braced himself with a stout stick. Ninian noticed, her eyes hiding the pity she felt, that he'd been forced to put my lady from him into the hands of a serving man, and she pretended not to see, knowing what a blow that must have been to his pride. She slowed her own steps on the path toward her dwelling place, and there she welcomed him, summoned her women to build up the fire, and sent for wine, of which he took only a token sip, and bowed gravely in thanks. "What brings you here so early in the year, Venerable?" she asked him. "Have you come from Camelot?" He shook his head.
"I was there for a part of the winter," he said, "and I spoke much with Arthur's counsellors. But early in the spring I went southward on a mission to the treaty troops. I should say now, I suppose, the Saxon kingdoms. And I take it you know whom I saw there, Ninian. Was that Morgause's doing or yours, I wonder?"
"Neither," she said quietly. "It was Gwydion's own choice. He knew he should have some experience in battle, druid teaching or no. There have been warrior druids ere this. And he chose to go south to the Saxon kingdoms. They are allied with Arthur, but there he wouldn't come under Arthur's eyes. He did not, for reasons known as well to you as to me, wish for Arthur to set eyes on him." After a moment she added, "I wouldn't swear that Morgause didn't influence his choice. He takes counsel of her when he will seek the counsel of any."
"Is it so?"
Kevin raised his eyebrows.
"Aye, I suppose so. She is the only mother he has ever known. And she ruled Lot's kingdom as well as any man, and still rules, even with her new consort."
"I heard not that she had a new consort," said Ninian. "I cannot see as well what happens in the kingdoms as did Vivian."
"Aye, she had the sight to aid her," Kevin said, "and maidens with the sight when her own sight failed her. Have you none, Ninian?"
"I have some," she said, hesitating. "Yet it fails me now and again." And she was silent a moment, staring at the flagstones of the floor. At last she said, "I think Avalon is drifting further from the lands of men, Lord Merlin. What season was it in the world outside?"
10 days have passed since the equinox, lady," said Kevin.
Ninian drew a long breath. "And I kept that feast but 7 days since. It is as I thought. The lands are drifting. As yet no more than a few days in every moon. But I fear soon we shall be as far from sun-tide and moon-tide as that fairy kingdom they tell of. It is ever harder to summon the mists and to pass forth from this land."
"I know," said Kevin. "Why, think you, I came at the slack of the tide."
He smiled his twisted grin and said,
"You should rejoice. You will not age as women in the outer world are prone to age, lady, but remain younger."
"You do not comfort me," said Ninian with a shudder. "Yet there is none in the outer world whose fate I follow, save..."
"Gwydion's," said Kevin. "I thought as much. But there is one with whose fate you should be concerned as well."
"Arthur, in his palace? He has renounced us," said Ninian, "and Avalon lends him no more help."
"It is not of Arthur I spoke," said Kevin, "nor does he seek help from Avalon, not now."
"But..." he hesitated.
"I heard it from the folk of the hills. There is a king again in Wales,
and a queen." "Urians?"
Ninian laughed, a scoffing laugh.
"He's older than those same hills, Kevin. What can he do for those folk?"
"'Nor did I speak of Urien's,' said Kevin. "'Have you forgotten? Morgaine is there, and the old people have accepted her as their queen. "'She will protect them, even against Urien's, while she lives. "'Had you forgotten that the son of Urien's had teaching here, "'and wears the serpents about his wrists?'
"'Ninian was silent for a moment, motionless. "'At last she said, "'I had forgotten that.
"'He wasn't the elder son, so I thought he would never reign. "'The elder son is a fool,' said Kevin, "'though the priests think him a good successor to his father. "'And from their view he is so, pious and simple, "'and he will not interfere with their church.' The priests trust not the second son, Accolon, because he wears the serpents. And since Morgaine has come there, he has remembered it, and serves her as his queen. And for the folk of the hills, she is queen too, whoever may sit on the throne in the Roman fashion. For them, the king is he who dies yearly among the deer, but the queen is eternal. And it may be that in the end Morgaine will do what Vivien left undone.
Ninian could hear, with a detached surprise, the bitterness in her own voice.
Kevin, not for one day since Vivien died and they came to set me here, have I been allowed to forget that I am not Vivien, that after Vivien I am nothing. Even Raven follows me with her great silent eyes that say always, "You are not Vivien. You cannot do the work Vivien spent her life to do."
I know it well, but I was chosen only because I am the last of Taliesin's blood, and there was no other, that I am not of the royal line of the Queen of Avalon. No, I am not Vivien, and I am not Morgaine. But I have served faithfully here in this place when I sought it never, and when it was thrust upon me because of Taliesin's blood. I have been faithful to my vows. Is this nothing to anyone?
Lady, said Kevin gently, Vivien was such a priestess as comes not into this world more than once in many hundreds of years, even in Avalon. And her reign was long. She ruled here for 39 years, and very few of us can remember before her time. Any priestess who must follow in her steps would feel herself less in comparison. There is nothing for which you must reproach yourself. You have been faithful to your vows.
As Morgaine was not, said Ninian.
True. But she is of the royal blood of Avalon, and she bore the heir to the king's stag. It is not for us to judge her.
You defend her because you were her lover, Ninian flared. And Kevin raised his head. She hadn't realized, set within the dark and twisted face, his eyes were blue, like the very center of flame. He said quietly,
Would you try to pick a quarrel with me, lady? That is over and gone years since. And when last I saw Morgaine, she called me traitor and worse, and drove me from her presence with harsh words such as no man with blood in his veins could forgive. Do you think I love her too well? But it isn't my place to judge her, nor yours. You are the Lady of the Lake. Morgaine is my queen, and queen of Avalon. She does her work in the world as you do yours here, and I where the gods lead me. And they led me this spring into the Fen country, where, at the court of a Saxon who calls himself King under Arthur, I saw Gwydion.
Ninian had been schooled in her long training to keep her face impassive. But she knew that Kevin, who had had the same teaching, could see that she must do so with an effort, and felt that somehow those sharp eyes could read within her. She wanted to ask news of him, but instead she said only,
Morgause told me that he has some knowledge of strategy and is no coward in battle.
How fared he, then, among those barbarians who would rather batter out brains with their great clubs than make use of them at their courts. I knew he went south to the Saxon kingdoms because one of them wished for a druid at court who could read and write and knew something of figures and map-making. And he said to me that he wished to be seasoned in war without coming under the eye of Arthur. So I suppose he had his wish. Even though there has been peace in the land, there is always fighting among yonder folk. Is the Saxon god not one of war and battles?
Mordred, they call Gwydion, which means evil counsel in their tongue. It is a compliment. They mean it is evil for those who would harm them. They give every guest a name, as they call Lancelot Elf Arrow.
Among the Saxons, a druid, even a young one, might seem wiser than he is, in contrast to all their thick heads. And Gwydion is clever. Even as a boy, he could think of a dozen answers for everything.
Clever he is, said Kevin slowly, and knows well how to make himself loved. I have seen that. Me he welcomed as if I'd been his favourite uncle in childhood, saying how good it was to see a familiar face from Avalon, embracing me, making much of me, all as if he loved me well.
No doubt he was lonely and you were like a breath from home, said Ninian. But Kevin frowned and drank a little wine, then set it down and forgot it again. He demanded,
How far did Gwydion go in the magical training?
He wears the serpents, Ninian said.
That may mean much
or little, Kevin said.
You should know that.
And although the words were innocent, Ninian felt their sting. A priestess who bore the crescent on her brow might be a Vivian, or no more than she herself. She said, He is to return at midsummer to be made king of Avalon, that state Arthur betrayed. And now he is grown to manhood. Kevin warned,
He isn't ready to be king.
Do you doubt his courage or his loyalty?
Oh, courage, said Kevin,
and made a dismissing gesture.
Courage and cleverness.
But it is his heart I trust not and cannot read,
and he is not Arthur.
It is well for Avalon that he is not, Ninian flared. We need no more apostates who swear loyalty to Avalon and forsake their oath to the folk of the hills. The priests may set a pious hypocrite on the throne who will serve whatever god he finds expedient at the moment. Kevin raised his twisted hands with such a commanding gesture that Ninian fell silent.
Avalon is not the world. We have neither strength nor armies nor craft. And Arthur is loved beyond measure. Not in Avalon, I grant you, but all the length and breadth of these lands where Arthur is the hand that has created the peace they value. At this moment, any voice arising against Arthur would be silenced within months, if not within days. Arthur is loved. He is the very spirit of all Britain. And even if it were otherwise, what we do in Avalon has little weight in the world outside. As you marked, we are drifting into the mists.
Then all the more must we move quickly to bring Arthur down and set a king on the throne of Britain who will restore Avalon to the world and the goddess. Kevin said quietly,
I wonder sometimes if that can ever be done. If we have all spent our lives within a dream without reality.
You say that, you, the Merlin of Britain.
I have been at Arthur's court, not sheltered in an island that moves ever further from the world outside,
said Kevin gently.
This is my home, and I would die, as I am sworn. But it was with Britain I made the great marriage, Ninian, not with Avalon alone.
If Avalon dies, said Ninian, then Britain is without her heart and will die, for the goddess has withdrawn her soul from all the land.
Think you so, Ninian?
Kevin sighed again and said,
I have been all up and down these lands, in all weathers and all times. Merlin of Britain, hawk of the sight, messenger of the great raven. And I see now another heart in the land, and it shines forth from Camelot.
He was silent.
After a long while, Linnean said, "Was it when you said such words as this to Morgaine that she called you traitor?" "No, it was something else," he said. "Perhaps, Ninian, we do not know the ways of the gods and their will as well as we think we do. I tell you, if we move now to bring Arthur down, this land will fall into a chaos worse than that when Ambrosius died and Uther had to fight for his crown. Do you think Gwydion can fight as Arthur did to take the land? Arthur's companions would all be ranged against any man who rose against their king and their hero. He is like a god to them, and can do no wrong."
"It was never our wish," said Ninian, "that Gwydion should face his father and fight him for his crown. Only that one day, when Arthur knows he has no heir, he must turn to the son who comes of the royal line of Avalon, and is sworn to loyalty to Avalon and the true gods. And to that end he must be proclaimed King Stag in Avalon, so that there may be voices when Arthur seeks an heir to speak for him. I have heard that Arthur has chosen Lancelot's son for his heir, since the queen is barren. But Lancelot's son is but a young child, and Gwydion already a man grown. If anything happened to Arthur now, do you not think they would choose Gwydion, a grown man, a warrior and a druid, over a child?"
"Arthur's companions wouldn't follow a stranger were he twice over warrior and druid. Most likely they would name Gawain regent for Lancelot's son till he came of age. And the companions are Christian, most of them, and would reject Gwydion because of his birth. Incest is a grave sin among them."
"They know nothing of sacred things."
"Granted. They must have time to accustom themselves to the idea, and that time is not yet. But if Gwydion cannot now be acknowledged as Arthur's son, it should be known that the priestess Morgaine, who is Arthur's own sister, has a son, and that this son is closer to the throne than Lancelot's child. And this summer there will be war again."
"I thought," said Ninian, "that Arthur had made peace."
"Here in Britain, yes. But there is one in less Britain who would claim all of Britain as his empire."
"Ban?" asked Ninian in astonishment. "He was sworn long ago. He made the great marriage before our Lancelot was born. He would be all too old to go to war against Arthur."
"Ban is old and feeble," said Kevin. "His son Lionel rules in his place, and Lionel's brother Bors is one of Arthur's companions and worships Lancelot as his hero. Neither of them would trouble Arthur's rule. But there is one who will. He calls himself Lucius, and he has somehow gotten the ancient Roman eagles and proclaimed himself emperor, and he will challenge Arthur."
Ninian's skin prickled. She asked, "Is that the sight?"
"Morgaine said to me once," Kevin said with a smile, "that it needed not the sight to know a rogue will be a rogue. It needs not the sight to know that an ambitious man will challenge where the challenge will further his ambition. There are those who think Arthur is growing old because his hair shines not all gold as it did, and he flies the dragon no more. But do not rate him low, Ninian. I know him. You do not. He is not a fool."
"I think," said Ninian, "that you love him too well for a man you are sworn to destroy."
"Love him?"
Kevin's smile was mirthless.
"I am Merlin of Britain, messenger of the great raven, and I sit at his side in council. Arthur is an easy man to love, but I am sworn to the goddess."
Again the short laugh.
"I think my sanity depends on this.
that I know what benefits Avalon must in the long years benefit Britain.
You see Arthur as the enemy, Ninian. I see him still as the king's stag, protecting his herd and his lands.
Ninian said in a trembling whisper, "And what?"